This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll be speaking with Susan Harjo. She is an American Indian activist. She is the founder and president of the Morning Star Institute. It's a foundation in Washington, D.C., dedicated to protecting American Indian culture. She is, in addition, a writer, a poet, lecturer. She has been very involved in developing federal Indian law dealing with things like sacred sites and graves protection. She was involved in a lawsuit that got national attention involving copyright and the Washington Redskins football team. She's also a founding trustee of the National Museum of the American Indian and is here visiting in the area here in, on the campus. And we'll talk about some of the issues facing Native people today, and people have questions. People who are listening have questions. They're certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're around Illinois, Indiana, listening on the Internet, use the toll-free line. And, of course, here in Champaign-Urbana, use the other 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for asking.
In preparing for the talk, I was looking at some of the columns that you wrote for the newspaper Indian Country Today, and I was very interested in one of the more recent ones about the opening ceremonies for the Olympics.
Oh.
And I guess what interested me was the feeling, what seemed to be coming across is your feeling that maybe sometimes what we want from Native Americans is we want for them to be decorative. And that's about it, and that we don't really want to know who they are. We don't really want to think too much about interactions between Europeans who came here and moved in, and we just we'd like them to dance. We like them to be colorful. That's good, but then we like them to go away. And that was as I was understanding sort of the thrust of the piece.
Well,
you think that's
yes.
Right?
That's what I meant to say. We are the heritage of America and the cultural backdrop for America, and we are referred to in the past tense almost exclusively. So most non-Native people don't come into contact with us because there aren't very many of us to begin with, 2 million, which is good. That's up from 250,000 in 1900. The bad part is it's down from about 50 million that used to be in North America around 1492. So our population almost went extinct. And during that period of the vanishing American, as we were called in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people thought that they were seeing the end of us. And I think that's when a lot of America began appropriating our symbology, and there and assigned a place to us, which was maybe giving an opening prayer, usually dancing for the white people and entertaining, and then just dancing backward into history. But the basic message that we've gotten, that the world has gotten from popular culture for a very long time, has been that most Native people are dead, gone, buried, forgotten at the end of the 1800s.
Yeah. Well, certainly here that's suggested a big challenge for Indian people, that is having a voice politically, having a voice in culture, having at the very least some sort of say into how you all are portrayed by the culture. How well, looking just say at the political issue, having some sort of political clout, how well do you think you have done?
Well, I think we've done very well considering that we have such low numbers of people. So in the political system of America, where numbers count, we have also seen democracy at work, where minority voices have to be heard in order for democracy to be truly viable. And that has served our interest well. And we have gone through various policy fluctuations, but by and large, in the latter half of the 1900s, we've been able to prevail on Congress or the courts or one or another administrations to do things that are in the long-term interest for Native people, whether that be in improved health care or in economic development ventures or in the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978, which was necessary because Indian religions were outlawed from 1880 until 1936. So we've been targeted for a lot of things that no other group in America has been targeted for, and like the Indian crania study. People don't even know that that was something that actually took place in 1860 until the end of the 1800s, where U.S. Army officers were ordered by the U.S. Army Surgeon General to go out and collect Indian heads for the study of heads, which was a great thing. So brains were weighed and skulls were measured, and the whole study around it in Europe and in the Americas was abandoned about 1898 when it was discovered that by all these calculations that the French were about as smart but not quite as smart as Cro-Magnon man. So the entire study of heads was abandoned. But in the meantime, a lot of graves were exhumed, a lot of heads were harvested of our people. So we're talking about nightmarish stuff, and all of that ended up, that collection of material, as they refer to it, ended up in museums. So in the roughly modern era, we have been trying to do things that are making up for, in some small way, things that happened a century earlier and 50 years earlier and 75 years earlier. So we've gotten a lot, we've made a lot of gains, and Congress has looked at some of the things that they allowed to happen in America and have made some serious changes. A whole revolution in museum policy, for example. And we are able now, as of 1989, to be classified under American law not as the archaeological resources of the United States of America, which is how we were characterized prior to 1989, but as living, breathing people who can recover our dead relatives from these museums.
Our guest this morning in this first, this second hour of Focus 580, Susan Harjo, is founder and president of the Morning Star Foundation. It is a national organization, national Indian rights organization, founded in 1984 for Native peoples' traditional and cultural advocacy, also arts promotion and research. She's also, in addition, writer, poet, lecturer. And does a lot of speaking on issues like these, visiting here in Champaign-Urbana. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to start out with, and that is in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Susan. It's nice to have your voice on the air here. Of course, we're embroiled in the controversy over the chief here, and I'm going to throw a compromise idea at you that has not been mentioned by the trustees. I think the main contradiction here is between the fact that we're dealing with big-time professional show business and amateur athletics. The fact that the chief is a racist image is incontroversial. Television will absolutely not put the chief on for any halftime event. They simply knock it off, and there's good reason for this. Now, Why can't the University of Illinois or any other universities, and I went through this at Marquette University when we retired the Warriors, which I think was the wrong thing for the right reasons. why can't we keep the fighting Illini, but pay Native Americans to put on a genuine halftime act that is simply authentic? And, I mean, people would come just to see the halftime act. What we have now is you have to pay to see the chief. You have to go to see the athletic events. And it's obvious. It's kind of unsavory, you know. You're going to see the, you know, something you want to see for the wrong reasons. Anyway, my friend Carol Spindell, who's author of Dancing at Halftime, says that it's too late for this compromise. We can't get Native Americans into the halftime show. What do you think about that? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
At the University of Oklahoma in the 60s, there was tremendous protest by Native American students and other students of color and the fledgling women's studies group there at the university to get rid of the mascot, Little Red. And the compromise offered by the university was that Little Red would no longer be a white guy dancing and making a fool of himself in inauthentic garb, but would be a Native person. And they went through two Native people, and then the third one just said, I can't do this. And the university finally changed and retired Little Red. There are still people I meet in Oklahoma and on the way to Oklahoma and in Washington who say, I miss that Little Red. I really like him. And the Native people are just so happy that was the first to go. And it was in 1970, Little Red became the first American school athletic program to drop its Native references. And that's wonderful. And the university still stands and has become a better university because of it, and they've been able to have a Native Studies component and do a lot of serious research and work with the Native people in Oklahoma. That's a really good example of how a good and fine school can continue on. There really is no compromise with racism. And the only compromise I heard was the Indian Voice being compromised yesterday out of existence and out of the debate. Like Johnny Carson used to say, you buy the premise, you buy the joke. And if someone is trying to reshape the table in such a way that the Native people are missing from it, that's really no compromise at all. That's just a further extension of the power structure that exists.
Since the caller opened the door to the subject, why don't we talk some about this, as I'm sure that there are people who are listening who would be interested in your reflections and also would want to express some opinion, and certainly that's welcome. First of all, I guess the basic point that the trustee, Roger Plummer, made in the comments that he made yesterday was that based on his conversations with people on all sides of this, he said that he said he thought there was really no possibility for compromise, and that the Board of Trustees faced one of two choices, and essentially keep the chief or get rid of the chief.
Which is what Oscar Wilde called a blinding glimpse of the obvious.
Well, I think I'll not comment on that. On the side of those people who might say that it would be possible to keep the chief, some people say that that they would want to keep the chief and yet make some unspecified modifications to reduce whatever offense people might take. And I guess what I'm interested in is whether, for you, it would be possible to, there's anything, any way you could change the way the symbol is presented now that you would feel would make any difference. Is it, in your mind, is it the case also that there's no possibility for modification, that it simply the chief should be retired?
Retired. Yeah. I think the thing that made sense that I heard yesterday was the possibility of retirement with and consignment to a position of honor. Or a position of at least where this symbol that had served the school for 75 years would be retired with some ceremoniousness and celebration. And I think that sounds just fine. I mean, that's where it is to be celebrated when you retire a 75-year tradition of racism. How would you go about modification? Say you have a lawn jockey and you say, well, let's paint the lawn jockey white. Well, no, that wouldn't work. Well, let's take away an arm. Well, no, I don't know if that would. Well, let's make it not a jockey. Let's make it a Superman costume or something. How would you exactly go about this modification? I don't quite see it.
I think for a lot of people, when they hear the chief described as racist, have difficulty with that because in their hearts they don't think that they are racist, and that they talk about the fact that they think that it's intended to be respectful, to honor Native Americans, and they might, in fact, they might share some of the feelings I know that you have about Native mascots in sports. And they might, for example, look at something like the Cleveland Indians mascot, Chief Wahoo, and they might say, okay, I get that. I can see why you would be offended by that, and I'm with you on that. Okay, we'll get rid of Chief Wahoo. But the Chief Illini work is different. The intent is different. What's in my heart is different. The way that's presented is different. I know that you would not agree with that, but I wonder if you can at least sort of see that, see where those people are coming from.
Oh, I can understand that. And it's not the same. I'm not saying that all the people who want to retain this racist symbol are themselves racists in their hearts or minds. I do think it's very difficult for white people in America to understand why Native people in America find that offensive, because we walk into the situation, we see symbology through the whole prism of our experience. We walk in there with our ancestors who were in museums. We walk in there with our people who were murdered and mutilated for praying for the good day. We have suffered the loss of land. We've suffered generational deprivation. When we see the symbols of our religions, the symbols of our cultures, when we know what a struggle it has been and to maintain our religions for those of us who have, and we know that 2/3 of the Native nations today in the United States of America had their religions not only driven underground but driven out of existence during that period of federal outlawing of religions. It is a mighty offense, and I don't know that the non-Indian people can truly understand what we walk into the situation with. That we do is an important thing for them to understand. I don't condemn all the people. I think that what they see as trivial, we see as a mighty offense, and that's not going to change. If we walked into court, it would be the Native people who would have standing and whose history would be listened to a very great extent, and not many others.
I want to ask one more thing, and then we have several callers, and I want to promise these people I'm not going to make them wait forever. We'll get to them in a moment. But one other question that I wanted to ask you to talk about, or one matter I want to talk about, and I think in this, as people, as non-Native people, non-Indian people, are trying to think about, okay, how do I feel about this? What's the right thing to do? They try to look at, well, what do Indian people say about this? And I want to ask you specifically about this, about a poll that was reported in a recent issue of Sports Illustrated magazine that deals with this issue of Native mascots in sports. And this was, it appeared on March the magazine March 4th. And essentially what they did was they went out, they hired a research group, they interviewed 351 Native Americans and also a number of other people, I guess, of unspecified ethnic background who were just said to be sports fans, and asked them, do you think that sports teams should stop using Indian team nicknames, mascots, and symbols? And that it, their finding was that 83% of the Native American respondents said, essentially said they got no problem with it. So as we are all thinking about, you know, what we should do with this symbol here at the University of Illinois, what do we make of a survey like that? And I think there probably are others that say most Native people, most Indian people, they don't care. It's just, it's not that important to them.
Well, I think the main thing that it illustrates is how they got the story wrong, how they got the poll wrong. How did the Harris people know who they were talking to? Hello, are you a Native American living on a reservation? Most people who live within the exterior boundaries of Indian reservations in the United States are white people today. How did they know who they were talking to? It all self-declaring, I guess. And they did say that they skewed their findings to the census figures, and that's also self-declaration. That's not the way Native people are determined to be Native people. We have Native nations. It's not very complicated. We know who we are. We know who each other are. The poll that I would trust more is the one Indian Country Today conducted. And Indian Country Today, for those of you who don't know, is the leading Native American newspaper. And only 7 months ago, they conducted a poll that showed 81% of the American Indian opinion leaders, the readership of Indian Country Today, were offended, were not honored. 81% were offended by the use of Native references in sports, 10% felt honored, and 9% weren't sure. So that's how that poll was. So you have the almost polar opposites. The only scientific poll that's been done is one that was done for our lawsuit regarding the name of the Washington football team in 1996, and was done by an expert witness who was qualified by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Board in our litigation as an expert witness, and whose findings said that there were about 60% of the, little more than 60% of Native people who were opposed to these various names. And that, I would, of course, that's valid and the Sports Illustrated poll didn't disclose even the questions that were asked, really. So I think it's suspect for a number of reasons, but primarily because they didn't know who they were talking to. In my experience of working on Native issues and reporting on Native issues and either observing or being an advocate over some 40 years, I can tell you that in any given campaign, whether it's for the Religious Freedom Act or for Sacred Lands Returns, for the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act, the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, the Child Welfare Act, all of these things, to build the National Museum of the American Indian, we've never had more than a couple of hundred people at most working on any of the, I mean, actively working on any of these issues. And with this issue, since the 1960s, we have had thousands and thousands of people, Native people, who are actively working on it. In 1970, there were over 3,000 of these schools with Native references. Today, there are 1,200, roughly. That's great. That means, for the most part, that you have Native families and kids working on this, not just one Native person per school, but many Native people, and it involves Native nations, every leading national Indian organization around any topic area has spoken out for a very long time, again since the 60s, and reiterating this in every decade and every few years, against these Native references in sports. Everyone, the National Indian Education Association, National Indian Youth Organization, the National Indian Lawyers Association, Native American Journalists Association, the National Congress of American Indians. We're talking about the Native people, not leaders who have a disconnect, who are disconnected from the people. We are the people. We're not leading this. We're articulating it for a whole lot of Native people. The statistics about us really mean something. Most of our Native population is not able to work on these kinds of issues. Those of us who can are in a luxurious position. Most of our population, you're talking about the most impoverished people, most unemployed people in America. The sickest people in America, the worst health conditions, most of us are dealing with daily life stuff. So you're not talking about a huge population that is even available to think about these kinds of issues. But in my experience, this is really a widespread matter, and it's something that people can understand. And if America can't deal with this simple issue, how is it ever going to truly resolve all the complex issues that we have to deal with on a daily basis?
We are a little bit past the midpoint. We'll get right to the folks who are holding on, and I appreciate their patience. Let me again, though, just quickly introduce the guest. Susan Harjo is the founder and president of the Morning Star Institute. It's a foundation in Washington, D.C., dedicated to protecting American Indian culture. She is also a poet, lecturer, writer. She's a columnist for the newspaper that we've mentioned, Indian Country Today. And if you're interested in looking at the paper and you have access to the Internet, there's an online edition. It's very easy to find it at www.indiancountry.com. All as one word, IndianCountry.com. So you can take a look at the articles. You can see her columns there, and you can take a look at articles about other sorts of things. I mean, if you're just interested in sort of what it is that Indian people are interested in, you can take a look at the paper that way.
Thank you.
We have a number of... I do meant to mention, too, that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, that Susan will be giving a talk at the Levis Center, 4:30 this afternoon, on the topic, The Invisible Minority, Voices and Visions for American Indians Today. So if you're here, and I assume anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome.
Oh, I hope so. Please.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some folks here. We have a caller over by Danville in Belgium. That's line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Where I'm in the larger percentage of our nation, I am not considered a Native American, though I do have ancestors that are Native Americans. So I understand the plight that the Native Americans have gone through in the today. The Holocaust doesn't even begin to compare to it. The slavery of our African-American citizens is really doesn't compare to it either, because we have totally destroyed the Native Americans. And I agree 100% with your cause. But I do have to state, I would like to know how you would like to be represented, and how far do you want to try to remove your representation in our culture, in that there's so many things in our area here that are named after Native Americans and use Native American words. Are you on a campaign to try to ostracize you from our type of culture, or is it going to stop someplace? Can you answer this? I'm going to go offline so we don't...
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, this is our country in a way that it's not other people's country. I mean, this is our homeland. We have no homeland to go to except this. And we're very proud of the places that carry the names that we assign to them. Those are very dignified. The state names are dignified. A school name would be dignified. What's not dignified is anything that diminishes us or cartoons us or mascots us. So we want to be portrayed in a way that we want. We want our images, our symbols, our voices, our words to come through. And in order to do that, we have to clear out the underbrush of stereotypes. I used to not think that this was the prominent issue. Now I think it's undergirding, contextual, atmospheric. The longer I develop public policy in Washington and look at how public policy is developed, I realize the importance of removing stereotypes from about Native people and any kind of symbology that makes us diminished people or people only in the past, in order to have positive public policy undertaken in our behalf that we design, that we say we need. Public policy isn't made for cartoons, so we want to be portrayed in the way we are, and that's multi-layered, multifaceted, lots of different opinions, lots of different cultures, lots of different ideas, lots of different philosophies. So let's get the non-native portrayals and the name-calling out of this. That's what we want.
Next caller is in Clifton. Line one. Hello.
Yes, Susan. I'm glad you're bringing this issue. And it was said earlier something about, well, people just don't care. Well, that's true about many things in this country. They don't care about this, that, and the other. But I think we should care about the plight of the American Indian and how they've been put down and how they've been pushed off into small reservations. And I've got a couple of comments. In World War II, I served in World War II, and there was one of the Indian tribes, I don't know which one it was, but they were able to communicate in their own language, and the Japanese could not break her code. And it was a big help, and those that served in the military did a credible job. They served honorably and with distinction and with bravery, and so I'd give them all the credit in the world. Also, I've got a little bit of difficulty with all this talk about Chief Alinowick. I graduated from the University of Illinois in 1947, and I used to see the chief get out there, and I never once thought that this was degrading. And I kind of wish people would just quit talking about it. I don't know. Part of my heritage goes back to Scotland, and if you'd get a bagpiper out there, make a caricature out of him, I wouldn't much care. I think it would be bringing distinction to the Scots people. So you can go from there, and if you got a question for me, I'll hang on a little bit.
Well, some of the Navajo code talkers who were the ones in the Pacific Theater that you were referring to are and were friends of mine, and many of them are artists, like Carl Gorman, who was one of the original Navajo code talkers. They're Choctaw code talkers in World War I, and many Native nations have developed codes within the language to aid in cryptography in World War I, World War II, Korea, and in Vietnam, and could be going on now for all I know. My dad was a native speaker, is a native speaker, Muscogee language, and
okay.
He came out of Shilako, Company C, Thunderbird Division in North Africa, Sicily, and on up. They're the ones who went straight up and liberated Dachau. Not my father. He was shot up in Monte Cassino. But what they did, that the Indian group, Company C for Shilako Indian Boarding School, all those Indian boys who could talk to each other in Muscogee and Muscogean and related languages, and people like my dad who could also speak Cherokee and other languages, they use those languages and the talk that they had developed as schoolboys to communicate with each other. They would just be handed walkie-talkies and say, there's an Indian on the next hill. And my dad was one of the people who could talk to a lot because he did not speak English until he was 9 years old and went to Federal Indian Boarding School and learned everyone else's languages. So there was there are a lot of levels of code talkers, and the Navajos were very specific and had a code within their language. And I must say that Carl Gorman and my dad and other veterans from World War II are very much in the forefront of this movement to eliminate Native references in sports. And you have to think that if so many Native people who have given so much to this country are saying, just stop doing that, stop this nonsense, how I don't understand how anyone else has the gall to substitute their judgment for my dad's.
Well, Susan, I guess I'm going to take issue with you on that. I've never thought that the Fighting Illini and Chief Illiniwek, I never thought that that was an infringement onto your people. And if it is, I'm sorry, but I never ever interpreted it that way. And I think that the more they talk about it, the worse the problem gets. And I didn't see anything wrong with it. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for fighting for freedom.
We have a couple of other folks here. We have about 10 minutes left, and we'll continue to take calls with our guest, Susan Harjo. The next caller up in line would be line number 2, and someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's sort of two things that I've learned from following this chief debate over the last couple of years that I'd like to hear your comments to. Or one is, I guess, something I've learned, and one is just the reaction. I mean, one of the things I think that people say, that, you know, that the chief is an honor to Natives and so forth, that seems to be maybe not, or kind of, at least among the university and university board, not so substantiated, comes out because, you know, other things other than the chief representation and other ways that the university could support Natives seem not to be particularly well supported by the administration and so forth. And so, you know, it seems like things like a Native Studies program, and I think there was something about a Native American dean or something, or some issue a couple years ago that you know, there are other issues that I think sometimes get lost in the debate about the very, you know, important issue of the symbol, that I think are evidence of a more systemic problem here at the university and probably nationwide. The other topic that was really interesting, and something I learned from Judge Garippa's report, you know, having grown up in Florida and still having a lot of family down there, one of the things that was interesting to read about was the involvement of the Seminole people in the Florida State, the debate about the Florida State issue, and their sort of negotiation and, you know, I guess the way that the university has provided scholarships and other kinds of things for the Seminole people. And I don't know how that relates to general feelings about the use of Native mascots and so forth, but I would love to hear your comments on that, and I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the Seminole people, contrary to the myth that's been spread around and was articulated yesterday, have not sanctioned the use of Florida State University's mascot or team name, which, by the way, the FSU has patented, has trademarked. How insulting is that? And most of the Seminole people, especially the Osceola family, is not happy with Osceola, who was a great Seminole patriot and who resisted Andrew Jackson's removal policy to Indian territory and out of the Seminole homeland in Florida, being used to pimp a football team. I mean, that's pretty offensive to the Osceola family. So That's how I feel about that. Of course, in this university, the people are dead. So the genocide was 100% successful. I don't know how you give scholarships for that, but there are 75,000 Native people in this state who should be given an opportunity to go to the school, and there and should be probably would want to go to the school were there not such a hostile environment toward the living people. I mean, when you have a symbol that is being honored, people say, and then when when a real Native person says, "I'm not honored," everyone says, "Shut up." That's not a welcoming environment for a Native student. But it's something the university should try, is to have some scholarships available, to have a Native Studies component, to do something that makes the university, that brings the university into this time, into this modern era, and out of a past that at best is disputed.
To Urbana line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I thought you said I was line 2. Well, anyway, I'm pleased to be on the telephone with your guest, and I would like to have her speak to the problem of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. I know that, I don't know if she's pro or con, of course, but I had a relative who is now retired from that bureau, and she was sort of a lowly employee, but she said that it was just unfathomable how the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't do for Indian tribes and Indian reservations, and just practically ignored them. And I wish your guest would speak to that, and I'd like to know how she feels about that. I came here to Urbana, the University of Illinois, in 1941, and I know, and my husband did too, and we were just thought the Indian at the halftime in the athletic program was a wonderful representation. And of course, we knew the costume was fashioned by an Indian tribe, and I'm not sure there was North Dakota or whatever. But anyway, I would really like to have you speak to yay or nay of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. I have no use for them. I am in favor of the Indians, any Indian tribes, and my great-great-grandfather was beheaded by an Indian, but that doesn't make me against them, and I am for a representation of all Indians, and especially Illinois, with our chief at athletic events. And that, and in the past, in the years that we've been here, a small group from the band and the chief would come to parties and events, and everybody thought it was wonderful.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes here,
okay,
and I want to give the
that, I'd appreciate
yeah
it.
Give Susan particularly a chance to talk about whatever your feelings of the effectiveness of the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Well, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is one of the oldest entities of the federal government, and began in the Department of War in the 1700s, shortly after the country was formed under the United States of America, and then transferred to the Interior Department about 160 years ago. So anything that old, and any bureaucracy, any federal bureaucracy, like any bureaucracy anywhere, is going to creak and just have some awful history. The history of the Bureau of Indian Affairs is really the history of the United States and its ill treatment of Indians, and then attempts to make adjustments and do a good thing, and then the policy swings back the other way, and so it's been pretty battered. It has only been within the past 10 years that Native people have been predominantly in charge of things, and there's been a vast improvement in the Bureau of Indian Affairs over that period of time, since the numbers of employees have been cut down and most of the employees are now Native people. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see over the next 10, 15, 20 years how Native people work in the bureaucracy and whether or not the Bureau of Indian Affairs can actually do good things to help Native people. But a lot of the time, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, when it's attempting to do something good, gets knocked for the good things that it's doing for Indians because it's doing good things for Indians, which is an interesting thing. And then, of course, there are a lot of us who have grown up with some pretty bad examples of what the Bureau of Indian Affairs have done and take it to heart that BIA means boss Indians around. But we can't really say that anymore now that it's 90% Native American.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We have a couple of callers we can't take, and there's much more we could talk about, but we've simply used our time. First of all, though, I do want to mention that our guest, Susan Harjo, will be giving a talk this afternoon at 4:30 on the U of I campus at the Levis Center. Anyone welcome. Anyone who wants to attend should feel welcome, and I'm sure she'll be touching on many of these issues. Among other things, also, she's a columnist for the newspaper Indian Country Today, which you can read online at www.indiancountry.com. Also, if you're interested in reading more on the subject of the controversy surrounding Native American mascots, you might look for a book that's titled Team Spirits. It's a collection of essays by different writers, and Susan has contributed one piece to this book. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. It's paperback and should be something you could find in the bookstore. Thank you very much.
Thank you.